today great. Today is such a great day. Everything is so great.
We're going to have a lot of fun. We got some wonderful people for you.
All you mommies and daddies out there who complain to the radio station, I got something to say to you.
And the first thing you've got to do is say the call letters properly. Okay?
It's an incredible metamorphosis of love and emotion and sensitivity and tenderness and fun and joy and happiness.
Did you know that this show represents health and hope?
Hillary is up. Trump is down. And the Mets are in the World Series. Of course, it's a great day on the Emmy Beth Berkley Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? I think those Benghazi hearings are still going on, right? Wow. We'll talk about the marathon session and whether or not it helped Hillary or hurt her. Also, Donald Trump falling for the first time in the polls in Iowa, and he got himself in some trouble on his favorite terrain, Twitter. Ouch. We'll talk. He's still riding strong, though, of course. And the Mets are in the World Series. I'm not going to gloat. I know. We have a little gift for our friends in Chicagoland coming up, too. We'll get your spook on as we get ready for next week's Spooktacular and some creative, fun weekend jumpstart tunes. Get you in the mix if you're listening live. It is Friday, October 23rd, 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east, number in motion 347-857-4505. And, of course, our busy 24/7 Twitter feed at AB Writes. The show today brought to you in part by Progressive Insurance. Find out how bundling can save you a bundle at progressive.com. And by Ford, power by design. But first, Justice Junkies, this one's for you. We talked about this. We're going to have Donna Thomas join us in just a moment. She is a noted crime writer who has interviewed a veritable who's who of the most wanted list. You know, when I was a kid in the post office, they used to have the most wanted signs. And I was standing there with a friend one day, and the guy behind the desk said, "Hey, girls, what are you looking at? You're not going to find a boyfriend there." Well, you could find some great subjects that are right about, and Donna Thomas has interviewed a slew of them, from Ted Bundy to Charles Manson and the Manson girls. From Betty Broderick to Henry Hill, John Gotti. Her latest book is on Timothy J. Boehm, who is was a adult porn star turned murderer. She wrote a book on Scott Peterson, working on one in Jodi Arias. Wow, Donna, welcome to the show. You are a busy woman who has talked to a lot of notorious folks. How are you?
I have. Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show, Amy.
A pleasure to have you here. So let's talk a little bit about your interest in this. I mean, so many people are intrigued by crime, but how did you get started interviewing these people? I believe I read that your first person that you interviewed was Ted Bundy. Talk about starting with the big boy.
I just had graduated from law school when I interviewed Ted Bundy. I was waiting to take the bar, so I had not yet taken the bar. And a family friend that was an attorney and was working on his appeal, his final appeal in Florida when he was on death row, asked if, you know, we're going to go do some round of interviews with him, do some work on his case. Would you like to come to Florida with us? Because I was in California. And I go, of course. You know, who wouldn't want to go when we were law student? So I went, and that's how I was able to interview him to begin with. That was in 1988. That was in December of 1988. He was executed like a month later in January of 89. He was executed. So I saw him a month before he was executed.
So tell us what
he was fascinating.
Like.
Well, it was fascinating. First of all, he had already been on death row for, you know, 10, 12 years already at that point. And he knew more. I mean, it was a room full of attorneys. He knew more about the law than anyone sitting there. I mean, he was in his
Well, he was a
law
student, right? When he was.
Yeah, right. He was in law school when he was arrested. And a lot of the cases, he worked on them himself. You know, a lot of people do that when they're in prison. But he was a very good, I mean, even the judges that he worked, that he appeared before, said it's a shame that, you know, you went a different way. You could have been a brilliant attorney. I mean, he was very brilliant, very charming. That's the thing with murderers and these types of people. You just would never know when you're sitting there talking to them. Unless you knew ahead of time that that's what he did, you'd never know that by talking.
Well, that's
to
how
him.
He lured people in, because he was also a good-looking guy, right? So he lured
very good-looking, very
in.
Charming, very
he seemed
smart.
Like a nice guy.
That's the common denominator, I find, with all of these types of criminals. They're very, very charming and
charming.
Very, very intelligent. They have very high IQs, high genius level IQs. Many of them have.
Well, I know Jodi Arias bragged that she was had an Einstein IQ. Although I think that was debunked during her trial. But we'll get to her in a minute.
No, but she does have a genius level IQ. She's very intelligent. She's just a raging sociopath, but she's very intelligent.
Yes. Well, this is the other question I have for you, and it's interesting that Ted Bundy, I don't know if folks know this, you probably know, was actually friendly with crime writer Ann Rule. They met on a crisis hotline,
right,
of all places,
yes.
I think is a fascinating story.
That. And she wrote The Stranger Beside Me, yes.
Yes, right, that was her big breakout book. Tell me a little bit about some of the differences. I mean, most of them, I'm sure the serial killers are all sociopaths, and certainly Ted Bundy was in that category, yes? You'd agree with that, right?
You know, there's a lot of debate. I mean, he's a psychopath. But, you know, I asked him several things. I asked him, first of all, he was a necrophiliac. We all know what that is, right?
Mm-hmm. Well,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, so
you
he may have
if
sex
you
with dead people, with
right,
a dead
right.
person. All right, so I said, why didn't you just work in a mortuary? And why didn't you do that? And he said, I tried. I applied to lots of mortuaries in Seattle. You know, he was from the Seattle area. And I didn't get anything. He said, you can't just make your own job. He said a lot of people that work in mortuaries are necrophiliacs. A lot of them are. Think about it. How would you know in the middle of the night?
Yeah.
You know? And he said, so that's the thing with him. I mean, that was his thing. I mean, would he have been killing people if he wasn't a necrophiliac? I don't know. Who knows? Obviously, he's a psychopath because he would, even
right.
being a necrophiliac, he did that. I mean, there's other necrophiliacs that do work in mortuaries and they don't actually go and kill somebody so that, you know, so that
right.
they can
well,
engage the illness.
Well, you don't, not all sociopaths are murderers, and not all psychopaths become murderers either. But
right.
I guess the difference
well,
is the level of insanity.
Many
but,
of them,
yeah.
Right. Many sociopaths can go through their whole life and never have any interaction with the law. It's when they snap huge. That's the problem with them. And it's estimated that around 80% of the population has some kind of sociopathic tendencies. We all know people like that. Like, they'll screw somebody over to get a job. They'll lie about
oh, yeah.
somebody. Yeah, that's a sociopathic
right.
behavior, but it doesn't escalate into illegal activity sometimes. But when it does, it's bad. There's no stopping. There's no rhyme or reason with it because they have no
yeah.
conscience. The conscience doesn't drive them. You know, there's been a lot of arguments, too, in the medical field. Is sociopath, is it a medical illness? Is it really? Because in court, when you try to go to court with these and use that as a defense, it doesn't work. The legal definition of whether someone can use an insanity defense is if they knew the difference between right or wrong. These people all know the difference between right and wrong,
yeah.
but they don't care. They just don't
they
have
just
a conscience.
Don't care.
They don't care. They try not to get caught. But yet, if they don't have a conscience driving them, then they're going to do it anyway. So it's like a gray area of the law, that one issue.
Yeah. It's fascinating because, as you said, it's a gray area, but also they don't have that conscience to stop them. They still have that compulsion to do it. So, you know, where is the deterrent? And there really
exactly.
isn't going to be a deterrent.
You know, Ted told me it was like being almost like being a drug addict, like a very heavily addicted drug addict on heroin, and you're getting withdrawals. This is what he said. No way of knowing whether it's true or not, because he had a problem with the truth. But that's what he said. It's like being a drug addict, and if you're actually having withdrawal symptoms if you don't do it, if you don't engage the illness. That's what he actually said.
Wow.
No
so
way of knowing whether that's true or not.
Right. Well. And does it matter? It's interesting to just hear his perspective because there's no way we're ever going to know for sure.
I think it's fascinating to figure out how their minds work. You know.
Yes, exactly. Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. So their perspective is their truth, or they convince themselves.
Right.
Almost like with Jodi Arias, you wonder, does she really believe she was victimized, or is she selling a story? And then after a while, she takes it on, like OJ, really was looking for the real killer on the golf course of his wife and Ron Goldman. You know, do they start to believe themselves if they tell that story enough? You know.
Yeah.
You know, because people
for
can.
Jodi,
people
I
can. I have a background in psychotherapy, and people can convince themselves of all kinds of things. That doesn't mean it's true, objectively true. So that is fascinating.
Right.
All those assets, all those facets of their minds and how it works and their motivations, I think is incredibly fascinating.
Absolutely.
But you met him at a time when he was at the end of the line, and did he know that he was going to be executed, or do you think there was still some hope there when you met
no,
with him?
No, he was pretty sure that he would be. You know, that's another thing with notoriety and the criminal justice system. Once you're in the web of notoriety, you never get out. It's another, he knew they were trying, they were doing a song and dance, trying to get him a stay. They had gotten him several stays at that point, several of them. But he knew that eventually he would be executed. And Florida and Texas are the two states then and now that execute the most people. Then it was, and now it is also. Florida and Texas.
And the fastest,
those two states.
Usually, right?
Where?
Oh, and the fastest.
Florida and
Texas, do it.
Those two states.
They don't seem
yes.
to have, like, California, you could be on death row, like Scott Peterson will probably
now,
never.
No, California
is
tabled. It's, I don't believe anybody will ever get executed.
Yeah,
again
that's what I mean. You know, take the,
yeah.
you get it,
yeah.
but it's a name only. It's really a life sentence. I'm personally not for
well,
the death penalty on a number of reasons. And,
neither
and
am I.
My audience knows,
neither am I.
Knows why. But
if you make a mistake.
Yeah,
you
well, you make
mistake,
a mistake, but also just the morality of it, I don't think it's up to us to take a life. But I also think the punishment level, you know, we don't really know what comes later, and, you know, who knows if there's a free pass at the end of the tunnel. And the notoriety, as you said, what happens is you kind of suck in a lot of good people, lawyers, advocates, to make you like a cause célèbre, like with Jodi Arias, spare her
exactly.
life. It's better that she's in life in prison. Let's try to forget about these people. Let them languish in prison. Whatever happens to them, happens to them. And by the way, I also believe there's some redemption. Maybe have a life, but you're in prison. You voted yourself, you know, off the island, so to speak.
Yeah, like
but,
Stanley,
you know, like I remember Carla...
Like Stanley Tookie Williams, I interviewed him. I don't know if you remember him. He was executed at San Quentin in California. He was the founder of the Crips, the gang. The gang, you know, he was a very famous gangster. There was a big movement, Save Tookie Williams.
Yes.
You know, Snoop
yes.
Dogg came out, Jamie Foxx, all these celebrities.
Well, didn't
came
he do?
Out.
He did a lot of work from behind bars, right? He turned his life
right,
around.
Right. That's
that.
Why I was going to yeah. say him, you know. And I interviewed yeah. him a lot when I saw him up at Sing. You know, he was a nice. I mean, he did what he did. We're never going to be able to change. He was never going to be able to change. But he was doing a lot of work with inner city youth. They'd come out there,
right.
and he goes, "Listen, this is what I did. You don't want to do what I did, or you're going to wind up here." You know, and that's a strong message when somebody like that
sure.
tells. That, so to continue, I'm very against the death penalty for a variety of reasons, like you said. But why that work that he did was stopped. The day he was executed, that was over. He could never get to another kid. I think it was more important to have him be able to get to kids than execute him. That's just my
yeah,
personal
I agree with
opinion.
That.
Right.
I'm with you on that one.
You know,
too, yeah.
his biggest regret in his whole life, I asked him this, was that he had a son. He has a son that's still on, not on death row, but in the general population of San Quentin for murder also. So he couldn't help his own son. He said out of all the bad, good, whatever you want, that was the biggest regret that I've had in my life, that
well,
I couldn't
sure.
stop
yeah.
him from leading in a life of crime. So,
well, unfortunately, that is a cycle, as you know, that a lot of people fall into.
Right.
Not just famous, notorious criminals, but people with the cycle of going in and out of the system. But what about Charles Manson, and how did you get involved with because you're in
yeah,
California,
well,
so you
I was just, you know, contact. I, after interviewing Ted, then I, you know, was an attorney for a very brief amount of time, hated it, hated the bureaucracy of the legal system, but decided to just explore that more, interviewing the criminal mind, writing about them, researching them, that because that's always been fascinating. It was that day, and it's never left me, and I'm feel very lucky I get to do what I love to do. So with Charlie, you know, I contacted different people. I actually interviewed the Manson girls before I started going up and seeing Charlie. He's up there in Northern California. He's not in San Quentin. A lot of people think he is, but he's not. He's at Corcoran, where Sirhan Sirhan is, the one that killed Robert Kennedy. They're both in the same prison, along with one of the Menendez brothers. But I interviewed the girls first, and I said, you know, Charlie, I've been interviewing Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Kramerinkle, because they're down here in Southern California. I'd like to tell you what they said. You know, I used that angle. Would you like to hear? You know, and so then I started, and I started interviewing him. But, you know, the interesting thing about Charlie is he's never actually killed anyone. I don't know if people know the case.
Yes,
or
I know
not,
that,
or,
right? He manipulated
he
these people to go out and do it.
That's what I'm saying about notoriety. Some of the actual killers have gotten out. You know, some of the ones that actually physically were there at those crimes did their time and got out. And that's another thing that people don't realize. A lot of people in the United States, with plea bargaining and all the other issues that are at play, the average sentence someone serves for first-degree murder is 12 years. 12 years. Most people don't stay in for the rest of their life. It's the notorious ones that we hear about. But most don't. There's not enough prisons in the United States to keep
them
all
in.
Well,
you really have to
upend
that whole system, because you sometimes, first with the plea deals and the way the overcrowding, you get people out for violent crimes and you have some people languishing for nonviolent drug crimes. That's a whole
for
other
drugs,
issue, which they're
drugs,
starting to address.
Exactly.
You know? But
that's
it's ridiculous
exactly
to have
correct.
Somebody in jail for a low-level drug crime for 15-plus years and have a murderer get out after
and
7 months.
And a child
molester's
out in 4 years, and you can't cure that. It's almost impossible to cure pedophilia, so they're out
yes,
in 4 years.
Well,
it's ridiculous
awful.
The whole way it works. It's terrible.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
But
that's why
but
I've
it's
always thought, too, that it's yeah. very important yeah. to try to rehabilitate these people, the ones that do not have life sentences, because they're going to be among, and we need to
well,
address
yeah,
that all.
Of course.
We don't, We don't address that at all because they just learn more about crime when they're in there. They
right.
get rehabilitated.
It's kind of a warehouse.
Terrible.
It's ridiculous. It's a waste. It's really a waste. You're right. Of money, time,
really
resources, and lives. But what about talk about Manson in a minute, but the girls fascinate me, too, because I think you didn't interview Susan Atkins, because I think what I've read
no,
about her,
I interviewed
and I know she passed away. I know she found religion in jail, as so many people do, but we'll talk about
yes.
that, too, in a minute. But I think she might have been a sociopath on her own. The other two, Van Houten and Krenwinkel, probably, if it wasn't for the confluence of Charlie Manson and drugs in the late 60s, they might not have been criminals at all, let alone murderers.
Agree.
But
I agree. That's I totally agree. And they've done the time. They've done almost 40 years behind bars and never
wow.
had any kind of behavior, nothing,
yeah.
never written up, not even written up one time. That's very unusual for someone to be in for 40 years and not be written up once, neither one.
Mm-hmm.
That's very unusual. You don't see that normally.
So what
you
do they get to do behind
kind of,
bars? Do they get some education?
Well,
do they have jobs?
Yeah, well, both of them teach other. They teach them to read. They do ministry work. Both of them do that.
They have something.
They spent most of their time teaching other inmates how to read. They both feel that's very important, especially the ones that are going to get out, so that they have good jobs, because they're very, very, very intelligent women. Both of them are. You know, that's the thing with these. You know, they're very intelligent. You know, he brainwashed them. He used brainwashing
oh,
techniques
yeah.
on all
yeah.
of these kids. These kids were graduates. Stanford, and you know, these kind of very hard schools. You have to be very intelligent to be able to brainwash someone, anyone, but to brainwash these smart kids. They were all smart. One was smarter than the next, and he was able to brainwash them. He's very, very intelligent when you sit down and talk to him. The craziness that you see on TV, that's for the cameras. When there's no cameras on, he's very mellow and very toned down. He's not crazy standing around screaming
really.
And yelling. He doesn't do that.
But he puts
no
on an act.
On.
It's
an act.
Really.
He's very, very intelligent. And I could see where, you know, because he's 80 years old. He's over 80 now. I could see when he was younger and healthy how he could have been very capable of doing anything he wanted to do, good or bad. He was able to do. He could have
charisma.
Done whatever he wanted to do. He had the mind to do whatever, but he chose to do that. So that's,
you
know,
the
bartering.
Apparently, the only thing he couldn't do was break into the music business, because that's what he really wanted to do. And when that didn't
yeah,
happen for him, I think.
Actually.
But what I'm saying is when it didn't.
Very...
Well, it's not the talent part. It's the fact that he didn't get the record deal, because he wanted to get a record deal. Wasn't
right.
it Doris Day's son? He was trying to get a record deal with him, and things didn't work out.
Guns N' Roses had recorded his music since he's been behind bars. I don't know if you knew that. Axl Rose
no.
used to regularly go and visit him in prison.
Really?
And record his music.
Yeah,
so he's had a lot of success in the music industry from behind bars.
Well, I can't be condoning that kind of stuff. It's just like the Murderabilia, all those people that buy his artwork or Jody Arias' artwork or
right.
John Wayne Gacy.
I know.
There is obviously an industry for that.
Murder. He just wrote songs and then they recorded it. I mean,
I understand, but I'm just saying.
Yeah.
I don't know that I can. You know, people can do whatever they want. It's a free market, and people will do it. I'm
right.
just saying, from personally, I would rather not. You know, see somebody like that benefit.
No,
like
I
Jody
don't
Arias
think so
don't
either.
Either. Or paint-by-number clown paintings, why give people...
Absolutely, and there used to be some really strong Son of Sam laws in place.
Yeah.
They're all overturned now because it's a violation of the First Amendment, of the freedom of, you know, speech. But I think that they should be. I'm with you. I don't think anyone should profit from the crimes, but there's no laws in place anymore. I don't know if you knew that. New York's maybe the only state where they have very strong Son of Sam laws in place. The rest of the states... No, these people can do whatever they want to do. The only requirement is that their family members are notified when they're going to do something to make money off of their crimes, which is wrong.
It's a big deal.
On a million different levels, but that's
right.
what we have now.
Why don't bother, because there's nothing I can do about it, so why tell me?
I know, but a lot of people think they can't profit, and they
can't. Yeah. Well, I thought it was
there's
you
no
can't
one,
profit. But... Directly, in other words, if you wrote a book about the crime, but some of these people get around it, or I thought, maybe I was wrong about that, that you're doing like the paintings, because that's not really about the crime per se.
No,
you're
but they can write
picture,
a book about
what?
Crime and profit. That's what
oh,
I'm
they
saying.
Can. Oh, they can.
Right. Lifted. They're allowed to do it
I
now.
See.
That's there's different. I interviewed another case, the Missy Avila case. I don't know if you. There was a movie about stranger among murder among friends with Patty Duke
played
the mother.
Yes, I remember that movie.
I've been interviewing that family. Missy Avila is Tiffany Amber Thiessen played the girl that was murdered. Because that woman, Karen Severson, that murdered that girl, is out of prison. I interviewed her. And she wrote a book.
Oh, really?
She's written a few books, and she's been out. She spent 23 years in prison. Both of the girls that were in prison are both out now. And the family is livid. And they're trying to, the Avila family, they're trying, Siobhan Avila is the sister-in-law of Missy, the one that was murdered, trying to change the law, Missy's law, trying to get it to where they can't profit from the crimes, because these two are out and have been, the Karen Severson especially, has been profiting. She's written two
now
books.
Have you interviewed Karen herself? What is your take on her?
I've interviewed the family and Karen Severson, yes.
And does she talk about
the
crime and what does she tell you about?
Well, you know, she was 17 when she did, they were all 17. They were not.
Yeah, I understand, but most 17-year-olds don't kill their best friends, so what was the story?
No, I understand that, you know, she said they were jealous. Got out of hand. She kind of lies a little bit, Karen. She pretends that she wasn't, you know, she turned around and left. But the family believes she was the mastermind. She did it. She didn't turn around and leave. But I'm not going to say, because I wasn't there. I just can tell you what she said. But she said it was a teenage jealousy. She was jealous because she was always going, flirting with their boyfriends. And that's what caused it, and that's what it was. And she said it was a mistake. I paid. I've been in prison for 23 years. What can I do now? I can't change any of it. I can't take it back, what I've done. I paid my debt to society. She said the family, I mean, it's like a war between her and the family. Because she keep at it, back and forth, and it's sad for the family, because it's 30 years already. The murder happened 30 years ago. It just was the 30-year anniversary in October this month. It was 1985.
Yeah, but you can understand where the family's coming from, right? I mean,
I understand what she's saying.
Yeah, you can't take it back, but you also, maybe you shouldn't be out of prison, because I think there are some crimes that are just so heinous that maybe you should be in jail the rest of your life. Do something constructive while you're in prison, but... What?
They were convicted of second-degree murder. That's why they got out. You get out when it's only second-degree murder. Even though the family believed, and that's another issue with the family, they believed the case was handled wrong, that they both got second-degree murder. Maybe the prosecution didn't feel that they could get them on first-degree murder. That's why they went for second-degree murder. That was the reason. So they got out. You don't stay in when you're convicted of second-degree murder. You get out eventually. I mean, they were lucky when you look at it. I said to them, you know, there's a lot of families that never get justice. The person never gets arrested, or they get out in 5 years, or they get out in 10 years. I mean, she did spend 23 years in prison. Both of them did. And they agreed.
Yeah,
they
I understand that, but I'm saying... You can look at both sides.
No.
I'm just saying, if it was my family member, I can understand where they're saying, well, she's out now and she's writing a book and she's having a life, whether
that's
it's good or not, I don't know.
And
but
I said to her, Karen, why continue to write books? I mean, don't you think that you're, you know, spurring the fire, keeping the fires burning by writing books about the family and saying horrible things? This last one is called My Life, I Lived It by Karen Severson. She said horrible things about the girl's mother, Mrs. Avila, terrible things.
Well, that's why they're upset.
You know, yeah, I said, why would you do that? I mean, you want them to leave you alone, but you're writing books and it's making them, of course they're going to be mad. You killed their daughter. And then you're saying horrible things about the mother?
And
she goes, I have a right to tell my story. She said, I have a right to tell my story. They're sitting and doing interviews all over the place saying lies about me. For 23 years, I wasn't allowed to say anything. Now I can tell my story. She said, I have a right to tell my story. It's my story.
Well, but this sounds a little bit like Jodi Arias. Everybody wants to tell their story, but a lot of it is lies in a lot of these cases, right?
Exactly.
I mean,
yeah, absolutely. Jodi Arias is another one, boy. She's really a piece of work, that one.
So tell me how you got involved.
You just sit there and you just sit there with her and you say, all right, well, what's a lie? You write it down and you think, okay, what looks like a lie? What looks like the truth? She's really something.
Well,
she's changed her story so many times
from the beginning. And, of course, it was obviously a premeditated thing, although I think she probably, you know, had he taken her back, might not have done it, which is mind-boggling, you know.
That's what I think. I said, Jodi, could you see yourself, like, in another life? Like, even though you're saying he abused you, and she sticks with that he was abusive.
Of course.
With some emotional abuse going on. But she says that he was – I said, even with all the abuse, I mean, you obviously were very, very infatuated with him and loved him or had this strong kind of feelings for him. Let's say he would have said, okay, Jodi, let's go and get married, and you can see yourself in another life being his wife, right? Even though he was, she goes, of course, you always want to find, you know, your Prince Charming and find someone that you can be with the rest of your life. So that's what it was all over. I'm positive.
Sure.
Because sure. You'd have to
I mean, there
go
so
around
many...
about way to get her to spill anything. Not directly.
Yeah, well...
You know,
well,
like...
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty
truth,
obvious, but it's
like
also pretty pathetic because here was, I mean, it's pathetic anyway. People do get obsessed with other people. We see that all the time, even to the level of stalking now, people cyber-stalking or you go on Facebook to find your ex, that kind of stuff. But they usually get over it. I mean, but this is a woman who,
right.
She got over
they
it.
They don't take it to that level.
Well, you don't take that level, but also this was a woman
but
who,
I will say it in this.
She went and had sex with someone right after she killed him, that she met in some chat
I know,
line or some dating
you know what?
Thing.
In this particular case, and I get a lot of heat because I don't romanticize people in death, Travis Alexander wasn't an innocent victim, not in my opinion, not in this case. It wasn't like someone unknown to him came in his house, broke in, and slashed him and killed him. That's not what was going on here. I think this is my opinion of this case, to sum it up. These were two very damaged people. He was very damaged, too. It wasn't just
yep.
Two very damaged people that met each other and could not stay away from each other. And because both of them were so volatile and so mentally ill, he had some mental illness, too. It wasn't just her, it was him, that this was the end result of that kind of these mental illness getting together. That's what I think it was. It wasn't. He wasn't an innocent party. Not
no, I agree
with
you. He doesn't deserve to be murdered,
what
though.
Was justified. But when you get a red flag, he was fortunate mm-hmm. enough to get those red flags. Lacey Peterson also got them and didn't listen to the red flags. When you are lucky enough to get those red flags, you got to run. You don't encourage
yes,
the red
yes.
flag. You got to run away from the. Not everyone gets the red flags. It's,
right. No,
it's
you're right. You're right.
And,
she was stalking
you know,
him after they broke up. They kept going back and forth with the sex. I'm sure there was some emotional abuse on both sides. I agree with that. I followed the trial very closely. But I don't.
Was,
I'm not as bamboozled as. Alice LaViolette,
right.
Who believes that she was a real domestic violence victim here. I mean, I think, you know, the difference is she was already, by the time she came back to kill him, she was miles and miles away from him. She's the one that initiated it. He didn't. He, you know,
right.
She'd moved.
She
now, yeah,
let
he let her in.
Out,
you're right.
So.
He should not have let her in. He should not have had sex
yeah.
with her. But at the same time, that doesn't justify her murdering him. So, you know,
no, but
there's
you
a
gotta,
difference.
But you got to listen to the flags. I think if anything with my work, if someone can look at this and see themselves maybe on either side of it and learn something
yeah.
and save their life or save someone, then it's all good. It's all worth
yes.
what that's important.
Yes. No, you're
but
right.
That's why to learn from these things. Because
yeah,
like,
no, you're right.
Read,
I agree.
Keep reading
but don't, but I don't think you should put in the blame, though. That's the thing. He had some red flags. He should have addressed it.
He
played
a part
in
his own demise, in my opinion. He did.
Yeah.
That's
yes.
That's the long
I guess
and short
so, but,
of it. In this current yeah. case that I'm the current the, this latest book that I wrote. I knew the victim. I did some work for him, J.P. Kelso. He was not a nice person. I am not going to go back and rewrite history and say he was a nice person. He wasn't. I didn't like him when he was alive. He was a horrible, despicable individual that treated people terribly. The last time I saw him, I said, one day you're going to piss off the wrong person. That's all it takes is pissing off the wrong person. 5 years later, after I told him that he was dead with a bullet in the back of his head, he was killed execution style. I mean, you can't, you know, listen, I'm not going to go back and change. It's a horrible thing what he did. Shouldn't have happened. Shouldn't have been killed like as a scared, alone, terrified. The last few minutes of his life was terrifying.
No,
but
tell
he,
people because a lot of people are not aware of this story.
No,
I know. Tell me, tell us, give us a little setup
Timothy
on the. Yeah, tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, about the porn star Timothy Boham. He worked under
right.
the name Marcus Allen. He was a huge porn star. I mean, you'd have to know, you know. Chichi LaRue was the pornographer that he worked under, who's directed Jenna Jameson, some of the biggest porn stars in the industry he worked with. You know, this. No, I didn't know him prior. I met him after because, of course, he killed somebody that I knew, and I'm a true crime writer, right? That was the irony in this particular case, and then I got to know him.
Right.
But J.P. Kelso, and I get a lot of heat when I write. I do not romanticize people in death. A lot of people, we do that as a society. We say, oh, they were the nicest thing since sliced bread. Saint this, saint that. That's not, I don't do that. Some other people can do it. I don't do it. J.P. Kelso was a very flawed man. He was not, he owned this huge collection agency in Denver called Professional Recovery System. Million, he was a multi-millionaire many, many times over. Flashy, dashy, openly gay. But he was a horrible man. I went in there to do some legal work for him, to go through some files to see which ones could sue, which ones could be sued and not. And he was, you know, I got up and left. And it was very good money I was making. I couldn't stand in the environment. He treated people so terribly. He was so mean and so nasty to the people that worked for him. I didn't want to be in a toxic environment like that. No money was worth it. So I left. And that's when I said that to him. I said, JP, one of these days, man, you're going to piss off the wrong person. That's what happened to him. He was blackmailing this kid. This kid came in. He was having a relationship with him for money. You know, you have to read the book. I mean, but that's how they got together. And then he didn't want to be in a relationship with him anymore, with JP, because he met a girl and the girl was pregnant and he wanted to marry this girl. And then JP was blackmailing him, telling him either you come, because she didn't know he had been a porn star, the girlfriend that he got pregnant. She didn't know that he was a big porn star. She didn't know anything about that, or that he had sex with men in the past. She didn't know any of that. And JP was blackmailing him and saying, either you come over here and you have sex with me, or I'm going to tell Christina, that was his girlfriend, say, about your past. I'm going to send her your DVDs so she knows who you are and what you are. And that's why he killed him. I mean, there's been a lot of stories in the media that he did it over money, and that he killed him because he was blackmailing him constantly. He'd be calling him up at 3 in the morning saying, he'd be laying in bed with the girlfriend, are you going to come over? Are you going to come over? You know, that kind of stuff. That's what he was doing. He just lost his mind. He couldn't stand it anymore. So that's what happened there. I mean, someone might say, you don't blackmail somebody. I mean, if he would have went to the police, the other guy would have been arrested, because that's a felony. You're not allowed to blackmail people.
Right.
You know, it doesn't make it right what Tim did, but you know what?
No.
You push somebody hard enough, they're going to push back. That's what I think.
Well, but of course, that's an interesting question, because it's never a good thing to kill somebody, but the question does become, can anybody be pushed to the point of being a murderer, or is it you have to have some hardwiring in you to do it? You know, and I don't know what the answer is, but I'm just, you know, fortunately, most people don't.
I think it's a
little
of both, maybe.
Yeah,
I think
you don't know.
For instance, I've had a gun. My entire adult life, I've always had guns in my possession and had them and liked them. And there's been plenty of people in my time that have made me mad and made me angry. I stay away from them.
Yeah.
I would never go and take my gun and shoot somebody. I wouldn't do that. I'm not. I've been
well, let's
in prison
hope not.
Enough times that I know that that's not a place I want to be in.
You don't want to be there, yeah.
No one is worth me taking their life. I would just never do that. But that's me. You know,
but who knows?
That's how I
but who knows? You say that now, but maybe if
no,
you're
no,
easy
no.
access to the gun, something would snap.
Several people that there were
you've been tested. You've been
several
tested. So let's go before you go, because I know a lot of people are interested in this case still, the Scott Peterson case. You've actually interviewed Scott in San Quentin, correct? You
many,
wrote a book about
many
him.
Times. Yes.
Yeah.
Many.
So
I'm
what's
the
deal here with this guy? Did he confess to you?
I'm the only one that wrote a book about Scott. That about Scott that actually interviewed him at San Quentin. I'm the only one that knew him before, during, and after. So
let me ask
you
this, because I haven't read the book yet. Well, I want to know about him, but I want to know if he confessed to you. Did he tell you that he actually did it? Because
he's
another one that keeps saying he didn't do it.
He slipped. I believe that he was innocent. That's how it first started. I really believed, I know that sounds crazy, but I really believed at first that he didn't do it, because he was telling me he didn't do it. I saw no physical evidence. He didn't even have a parking ticket when he was arrested. All that I knew about murder, I still didn't think he did. I thought he was innocent. I saw a lot of holes in the case, gaping holes, bad handling of the case, horrible stuff that wasn't. I didn't think it was prosecuted properly. I thought it was all unfair. I mean, it was too much pretrial publicity in his case. Everybody was vilifying him before he was even arrested. And that did go on. I don't think his trial was fair by a long shot. Even though he's guilty, he still had an unfair trial. That's what I believe. And that's the contention for his appeal now, that they're appealing that the trial was unfair. They went right in my book and got all my points that I gave in the book and wrote the appeal, basically, is what they did. But anyway, but it is true. I mean, just because he's guilty doesn't mean that with anybody, doesn't mean that you're trying.
Okay, yeah, I know. I understand that, but that's not really what we're talking about now. I want to know, but you said he confessed to you, right?
So one day I was, so every time I went to St. Quentin and interviewed him and talked to him, we discussed the case, because I was going to write a book about the holes in the case and how, you know, how he was innocent.
Right.
So we would always discuss evidence. One day I went in there and I said, Scott, do you know the case and the evidence, Amy, very well? I mean,
I know pretty
evidence.
Well. It's been several years now.
Right, so
I did
we
follow
were
it at the time.
The boat launch slip. The thing is, his pregnant wife, Lacey Peterson, she was 9 months pregnant. She went missing on December 24th, 2001. 2002, this was. This is a long time ago already. Can you believe it's that
That's what
long?
I mean. It is a while ago, yeah.
Yeah. And then for 4 months, there was no body, no nothing. She was missing.
Right.
Okay. Then in April, her body,
yeah,
and
Easter.
The body of her unborn son washed ashore in the San Francisco Bay. And shortly,
it was like Easter
he was
weekend,
looked
right?
At, what?
It was Easter
what?
Weekend, I think. It was
Easter weekend. That's correct. Yes.
Yeah.
And then he was arrested shortly after that. I mean, he was always being looked at. Everybody was
right.
saying he was guilty. He was denying it. So then, when they had the bodies, they arrested him. Okay. Now, he was saying it wasn't me, I didn't do it, blah, blah, blah. So we would, his alibi for the night that she disappeared was he was fishing in the San Francisco Bay, and she supposedly disappeared in Modesto, which is 90 miles away. So I said to him, you know, this is really weird, Scott. I was just going over evidence, because I would do that. I would read evidence right before I was going to go see him so we could discuss the evidence. So the evidence that I read that time was about the boat launch slip. He had the boat launch slip. He showed, the police said, where were you, Scott? I was fishing in the marina. Here's my boat launch slip. So I said, you know, that's the craziest thing, Scott. They had your boat launch slip. They knew that's where you were, but yet that night they were showing your pickup truck, and they were saying, if anybody's seen the pickup truck and blah, 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 call the police. I said, they should have shown Lacey's car. She was the one that was missing. Why were they showing your boat launch slip, your truck, when they knew where you were when you produced the boat launch slip? That makes no sense to me. He goes, and I know, and I did everything. I put it in my pocket to make sure that it wouldn't fly out. I checked it when I was in Livermore, which is in between, to get gas. He said, I kept making sure that I had that boat launch slip. So when he said that, I knew that he was guilty. When he said that, I just stopped. And look at your watch for 2 minutes. Yeah. 2 minutes, I sat in that cell with him, where he was 4 inches from me, no glass, nothing, contact visit, and I didn't talk because I was so shocked that he, for a year and a half, he was saying he was innocent at that point.
Well, I'm shocked that you thought he was innocent because all, I know it was all circumstantial evidence, but the fact that he had that Amber Fry affair, that he was lying to Amber Fry about where he was, that he wasn't showing up, he wasn't involved in the search. I mean, it'd have to be a Mary Higgins Clark book with a twist of being, it's got to be somebody else for him to not have been the killer. So I'm kind of surprised that you're such an astute crime writer that you really bought it.
I believed him.
You were sucked
point.
In, Donna. You were sucked in after all these years of experience.
I know. I was sucked in. I felt really stupid after that. Trust me. I felt really dumb and questioned my own. He's very good. He's a sociopath. You know, he's very smart.
Yeah, he must be.
I didn't do this? Because I know it looks really bad. I know it looks like I'm guilty, but I didn't do it. I swear to God, I didn't. I mean, he was saying that all the time, constantly. You know, and then he's a sociopath. Listen, he told me for years that he was a Democrat, a registered Democrat, because he knew I was a Democrat. This is the kind of things they lie about, that he lies about. And then I find out after that he and Lacey were both registered Republicans. You know, they're very chameleon. Right. They just kind of mold with you. They tell
you
what you want to hear.
Yeah, of course.
That's what they do.
That they can
mimic.
That's what sociopaths can do. They can mimic what they think
exactly.
You want to hear, the kind of behavior, which is why when
I
they always say...
I thought after I knew he was guilty, but all the signs were there, even for me. So that's how nobody knows. Even I, who had so much experience already at that point with Mert, I didn't see it at all with him. And if I can be fooled, I think a lot of people can be fooled. And a lot of people are fooled.
Yeah.
They are. It's very scary. That's why I tell people, especially when you see the red flags, get out. She saw the red flags, Lacey. He was always cheating on her. When they said that, you know, they were the perfect couple, that wasn't true. That's part of the reason why I thought maybe, you know, they're saying that was the reason for Amber Fry. There were hundreds of Amber Frys for Scott. I knew that he wouldn't leave her over Amber Fry because I knew that he was never faithful to her. That's another reason why I thought maybe he was.
But why did he want her out of the picture? Because he didn't want to have
because
the
baby? Because she was pregnant. He said
yeah.
he would be attached to her for the rest of his life because she had a baby. And he hated her family. That was another thing. Everybody made like everything was wonderful between them. He didn't like her mother. He didn't like the stepfather. Mm. He hated her family. He said, even if I divorce her, I'll never get rid of that whole bunch. I just hated them.
Yeah.
I didn't
well, that's why they always say that pregnant women, really, that's a time when they're very vulnerable to being murdered because significant boyfriends or husbands,
the number
they
one
want out.
The death among pregnant women is homicide.
Yeah. I mean, that's awful.
Crazy.
You got to know your partner really well, I guess. It's a fascinating endeavor. I'm surprised you got caught, but now you know, and you revealed it in your book, so I guess he's not going to be talking to you again.
Well, I have talked to him after the book came in, but he's not fine. He goes, you know, you do what you have to do. We all do what we have to do. I said, well, Scott, you lied to me for years and told me you were innocent and wasted my time. What do you think I'm going to do?
Well, he's lied to everybody.
Come on.
I mean, I'm surprised he doesn't believe it, because at some point, you think Jodi Arias believes that she really was a domestic violence victim? She's convinced herself of that yet?
No, she doesn't believe that. No,
it's all an act.
She knows she's lying. Yeah, she knows she's lying.
No, she's lying.
He knows she's lying.
But everybody
knows
she's lying except
know.
Alice LaViolette, right? She's the only one that bought the act.
No, I think Alice knows, too. But you know something? I think what people went and did to her, you know, what they did to her on Amazon, but that's not right either. Two wrongs.
Oh, that was awful.
Right.
That
oh,
when they wrote
bad
reviews. Oh, yeah, that was
no
horrible.
No one's
going to want
to testify in these cases if people just
carry
on.
No, I agree with
it
that.
Shows
no, that
how
was, that's
wheel, everyone. I mean, it shows
that's
how mentally
ridiculous
ill the masses are. Rational person wouldn't do that to someone else.
Right.
Crazy.
Of course.
You know,
of course. But people react. I mean, that's a whole other topic. We don't have time for that today. But yeah,
I know exactly.
When people react. But fascinating. You have a great body of work. If people want to get all your books, your latest is intended for mature audiences. That's the Timothy J. Boham case.
Right.
That's out now. You're working on Arias. Is that right? When is that going to be in the
world? That one I'm kind of tabled because I want to get the family. So until I can get the family to cooperate with me. Then it's an evergreen project. You know what that means, right? That there's no date, there's no end date.
Boy, do I know what that means.
I'm working on another one, a historical crime piece that's top secret right now. So
okay. So if people want to find out all your works, you have a website they can go to?
No, they can find me on Twitter. I'm working on a website, actually. It's a new endeavor also where I'm going to be writing all my articles. You know, fandaily.info, I write for them all the time.
Okay.
I have a lot of exclusive interviews that I do with people on true crime cases. If anybody has a crime case you want me to look at, Ms. Donna Thomas on Twitter, find me there. Send me your information, and I'll get back to you. So that's the best way. The books are all on Amazon and through the publishers.
Okay, fascinating.
They're all on Amazon. Okay.
Okay. Great, Donna. Thank you so much for joining us. A font of intriguing information. I hope you come back and see us when you're done with Arias and your next big top secret project.
Okay, I will. Thank you so much, Amy. Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you for having me on the show. Thank you.
A pleasure. That's Donna Thomas, Justice Junkies. You got your fill. Details, of course, if you want to reach out to Donna at Twitter is the easiest way, Ms. Donna Thomas. It is the Amy Beth Berkowitz Show. Give us a call, 347-857-4505. And the Twitter feed, of course, for us, AB Writes.
Virginia, rode a boy with a six gun in his hand, and his daring life of crime made him a legend in his time, east and west of the Rio Billy the Kid. Well, he never traveled heavy, yes, he always rode alone, and he soon put many older guns to shame. And he never had a sweetheart, and he never had a home, but the cowboy and the rancher knew his name. Utah to Oklahoma, and the law just could not seem to track him down, and it serves as a legend well for the folks they love to tell about when Billy the Kid came to town. We'll be right back.
The Amy Berkley Show with the Ballad of Billy the Kid, one of our most notorious historical criminals. The Amy Berkley Show, did you hear about that photo of Billy the Kid? Apparently there are only like two known photos, and one picked up at a garage sale for, I think, $5 or less, is going up at auction or was sold for $5 million. Wow. I think maybe this weekend with a little garage sale hunting may be in order. Thanks again to Donna Thomas, speaking of notorious criminals, for joining us. Boy, has she interviewed and written about a plethora of intriguing and notorious criminals, but can't believe that it was a gotcha moment with Scott Peterson, that he sucked her in. Wonder about that, Donna. You got to watch yourself. Look for those red flags. On the Twitter feed at AB Writes, Sammy chimed in, great interview, intriguing stories for sure. Brian says, can't believe she bought Scott's story, what a sociopath he was. Is, yeah. Sounds like it, but he wrote the book, and it's kind of a scathing review, I guess, of not just Scott, but it sounds like Lacey's family as well. But, you know, she's right. You got to put it all out there, and what is so fascinating are the multifacets of these stories and what we call in counseling looking good families. Very often everything looks perfect, the perfect marriage, the perfect couple, the perfect family, and it really isn't. And that's what I like to write about, too, in fiction, is what goes on behind the scenes and underneath and all of that. So fascinating indeed. We'll take a peek at that. And Shelley says, great interview. Now on to politics. Thanks for the segue, Shelley. Indeed, we're going to go to politics with the Benghazi hearings. It went on and on and on. And what did we learn? Anything new? Well, I didn't see the whole thing because who has time to watch the whole thing? I guess some people in the news biz did. But I saw enough of it to know what was happening, and it seemed to be a relentless barrage of the same questions they've asked over and over again, waiting to get a different reaction from Hillary Clinton, waiting for her to explode. She did not explode. A couple of the people on the panel did. Elijah Cummings on the Democratic side had a couple of attacks on his colleagues and impassioned pleas for them to get on with it. And some of the Republican congressmen and women were attacking her directly and really trying, I think, to undermine her and get her to have a volatile reaction when they kind of accused her of not caring about these people and what was she doing. It's all very murky. I think she used the term fog of war, but she was definitely on duty when it happened and they found out about it and they were scrambling to know what was what and try to resolve it. Four people tragically killed. It is horrible. These hearings, though, have gone on. There have been several committees on this. There's been the review boards on this. If you couple that with the amount of hours and resources that were spent on this with four people dead, and compare that to the 9/11 hearings, George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, 2 hours and change, behind closed doors, not televised, over 3,000 people killed. So I'm just saying the magnitude of these events. You know, you have to weigh it, and you have to wonder. You know, when they talk about the witch hunt, you see why people think it's that way. Now, on the other hand, I don't know that she changed too many people's minds, because if you really didn't like her before, you probably still don't like her. If you believed it was a witch hunt and you do support her, you probably support her. But maybe you support her even more, because the one thing that she did do was show how tough she is, her stamina for sure. Any questions on that? I mean, she endured 11 hours pretty much. I mean, they did take a lunch break and a dinner break, and, you know, presumably a couple of bathroom breaks. I saw her drinking a lot of water, so I don't know. But she was up there for a very long time, and they were questioning her, but it was her on the hot seat the entire time, and I think she kept her cool. You could tell her facial expressions, there was some disdain and contempt being issued, but, I mean, who can blame her after a while, if you know what I'm saying? So on the Twitter feed, a lot of people are talking about this. Hey, Dino says, Trump speaks out on the Benghazi committee, and he says, they're not sending their best. Some are criminals. Some, I assume, are good people. We'll get to Trump on Twitter a few minutes later. Representative Linda Sanchez, who is on the committee, said nothing new has been learned after the Benghazi hearings, and they went on and on forever. Richard says Clinton emerges stronger for the next phase of the campaign. Yeah, she had a pretty good week because she did well in the debates last week. Joe Biden took a pass this week, and she fared well at the hearings. So, yeah, I think she did have a good week. That's what you see what that is. Phelps says 11-hour Benghazi committee hearing brought to you by Depends. Yeah, well, that's the thing. She was drinking water like crazy, so I don't know. I'm sure they took some breaks that I didn't see. Some of the headlines, Slate, well, yeah, it's a liberal-leaning website, so you got to take this with a grain of salt, I guess, but their headline is the spectacular, self-destructive, partisan embarrassment of the Benghazi hearing. Weigh in, your take. AB writes, phone line 347-857-4505. Now, Donald Trump, interestingly enough, he fell a little bit in the Iowa poll, the latest Iowa poll. Ben Carson the lead now, 27%, Trump down to 19%, and he retweeted, I can't find that tweet, do we have it? I want to find that Trump tweet. I don't think we have the original tweet, that he retweeted somebody saying, Trump down the polls, must be too much Monsanto, the company that does all the chemicals and so forth for farming, ruining the corn, or too much Monsanto in the corn, does it damage the brain, or something like that. So he retweeted that. Boy, did he get flack for that, of course. Quickly made a retraction and said it was an intern who retweeted it and apologizes. Now, do we believe that? Is that a good enough excuse? Well, you know, he's gotten away with so much before, but, you know, my take is you don't want to start, you know, hitting the voters because they haven't voted yet. You want to go try to win them over. That's my take on that. Reach out via Twitter, AB writes. Do we have anything on that? People are talking about Trump being great so far. See, I got my Trumpians out. They come out in full force. I don't know. Trump is going to make America stronger. It doesn't matter what he says. People like him anyway. Okay. That's so says Schilling. Schilling or Schill? 405 says, bigger than Trump, Hurricane Patricia is coming to town. Yeah, that's no joke out there in Mexico. It's slated to hit. Supposed to be a bigger hurricane than Katrina. So we'll have to watch the weather. Fortunately, if there's an upside to this, where it's tracked to hit is a very low populated area. So that's just something to keep in mind if you're headed. If you live near there, you're headed in that direction this weekend. Be careful. Joe Teabag says, given the Iowa poll numbers, GOP candidates no longer want to dress up as Trump for Halloween. Well, we'll see. We'll just have to see how that all goes, as they say. So the Mets won. I'm so excited. They're going to the World Series. They swept the Cubs, and they're waiting to see whether they're going to Toronto or Kansas City for Game 1 of the World Series. Haven't said that in 15 years on Tuesday. So we'll see what happens there. But I know my Chicago Cubs fans are bereft. I normally feel your pain, so we'll have to give a little send-up. A classic from Steve Goodman. It's a dying Cubs fan request. Brilliant.
By the shores of old Lake Michigan, where the hawk winds blow so cold, an old Cub fan lay dying. In his midnight hour, the toll. Round his bed, his friends had all gathered. They knew his time was short. On his head, they put this bright blue cap from his all-time favorite sport. Told him, it's late, it's getting dark in here, and I know it's time to go. But before I leave the lineup, boys, there's just one thing that I'd like to know. Do they still play the blues in Chicago when baseball season rolls around? When the snow melts away, do the Cubbies still play in their ivy-covered burial ground? When I was a boy, they were my pride and joy, but now they only bring fatigue to the home of the brave, the land of the free, and the doormat of the National League. Told his friend, you know the law of averages says anything will happen that can. That's what it says. But the last time the Cubs won a National League pennant was the year we dropped the bomb on Japan. The Cubs made me a criminal, sent me down a wayward path. They stole my youth from me, that's the truth. I'd forsake my teachers to go sit in the bleachers in flagrant truancy. And then one thing led to another, and soon I discovered alcohol, gambling, dope, football, hockey, lacrosse, tennis. But what do you expect when you raise up a young boy's hopes and then just crush him like so many paper beer cups, year after year after year, after year after year after year after year after year. So those hopes are just so much popcorn for the pigeons beneath the L tracks to eat. He said, you know, I'll never see Wrigley Field anymore before my eternal rest. So if you have your pencils and your scorecards ready, I'll read you my last request. Give me a doubleheader funeral in Wrigley Field on some sunny weekend day, no lights. Have the organ play the national anthem, and then a little na-na-na-na, hey-hey-hey, goodbye. Make 6 bullpen pitchers carry my coffin, and 6 groundskeepers clear my path. Have the umpires bark me out at every base in all their holy wrath. It's a beautiful day for a funeral. Hey, Ernie, let's play too. Somebody go get Jack Brickhouse to come back and conduct just one more interview. Have the Cubbies run right out into the middle of the field. Have Keith Moreland drop a routine fly. Give everybody 2 bags of peanuts and a frosty malt, and I'll be ready to die. Build a big fire on home plate out of your Louisville Slugger baseball bats, and toss my coffin in. Let my ashes blow in a beautiful snow from the prevailing 30-mile-an-hour southwest wind. When my last remains go flying over the left field wall, we'll bid the bleacher bums adieu. I will come to my final resting place out on Waveland Avenue. The dying man's friends told him to cut it out. They said, stop it, that's an awful shame. He whispered, don't cry, we'll meet by and by near the Heavenly Hall of Fame. He said, I've got season tickets to watch the Angels now. That's just what I'm going to do. But you, the living, you're stuck here with the Cubs. So it's me that feels sorry for you. And he said, oh, play that Lonesome Losers tune. That's the one I like the best. Closed his eyes and slipped away. Scotty, it was the dying Cub fan's last request. So here it is. Do they still play the blues in Chicago when baseball season rolls around?
cubbies still play in their ivy cup with their yo-ground. When I was a boy, they were my pride and joy, but now they only bring fatigue to the home of the brave.
The Northside Die Hard stole the show.
The land of Wrigley's in my soul. Come on, Cubbies, let the good times roll. Roll all day long.
Come on, Cubbies, let the good times roll. America's team, so I've been told. Come on, Cubbies, let the good times roll.
Show and the classic Steve Goodman lament, a dying Cubs fan request. For all my friends in Chicagoland and Cubs fans worldwide, maybe next year, this year is ours for the Amazons. We hope. Don't get cocky, guys. It is the Amy Bethurkwi Show. Reach out via Twitter, AB Writes. If you're listening live Friday, October 23rd, the phone line is still open, 347-857-4505. And a couple of folks still chiming in about Benghazi and Hillary. Claire said, and Biden a little bit, said, sorry to see Joe Biden not get in, but now I know why, HRC all the way. Yeah, she came out strong for sure. Sandy said, Hillary looks stronger than ever. And Brian says, Trump wants to run against Hillary. Can't wait to see it. Yeah, that's going to be some spectacle. If it comes down to that, we'll see. Lots of folks on the Facebook, too, chiming in where you got more space to talk. Exeter says, quoting an article that quoted Red State's Eric Erickson, the right-wing blogger who said the Benghazi hearings are a waste of time. In fact, he was quoted as saying, it was all a political spectacle and a carnival roadshow of the backbench cross critters. And Exeter says, how come there are not more people on the Republicans calling out the unmitigated treasonous, seditious BS of their own party? They are allowing their own party to be destroyed. I'm sorry, they have allowed their own party to be destroyed. They are no more. We'll see. Dan writes, so now one of the other non-Democrats, Lincoln Chafee, you know, he used to be a Republican, now he's a Democrat, has dropped out. I didn't know he dropped out, and most people didn't know he was in. Governor Chafee cited the strength of HRC's debate performance, the public admission by the Republicans that the Benghazi Special Committee is a sham, and the amazingly strong and presidential-like appearance by HRC in front of the GOP Benghazi fundraising telethon. That girl is on fire, and her rise in the polls is only going higher. Okay. As I said, the gal had a good week, for sure, right? Speaking of people with a good week, let's do our Inspiration to Action Challenge while we still have a little time here. For Donna, not our guest, but different Donna, in New Hampshire, who says she's working on poetry and pottery, the two P's of the artistic world, and she's having a good time doing it. She says, I got more focused and more serious and also more joyful. Guess what? It works. You know, kidding. The Inspiration Action Challenge can help you get your groove back if you give it time. I think a lot of people have pointed out you got to do it over time because I think of it as like a meditation. If you keep doing it, something kind of just happens. You get more centered, I think, and more joyful and peaceful. And that's a great place to be if you want to create something, I got to tell you. If you're too chaotic, too frenetic, and I can say this from my own experience, it doesn't always work. You got to have some time to reflect and relax, and this is a form of meditation. Now, some people just do traditional meditation or whatever it works for you, but this can help you really plug back into your creative resource, I think. So try it. Give it some time. Give it a few weeks, a couple of months. See if it works for you. And if it does, hey, listen, I'd love to give you a shout-out because I think you deserve it, of course, but you also can help other people get inspired. So drop me a line over the website. It's amybetharkowee.com. Or easy access via the Twitter feed if you can have a problem. If you have a problem with that last name, it's A-R-K-A-W-Y. And you can also stop by the website should you need a conversation to go over the challenge as well as other things we can do to help you get your creative mojo back. AmyBethArkowee.com. Stop by, and while you're there, peruse my stories, The Eliza Gordon Mysteries, both Killing Time and Dead Silent, are now available for ebook and paperback. So way to go, Donna. Keep us posted. And, yeah, you know, it's Halloween. Next week we have our annual Spooktacular. We have Cram the Crypt with some deliciously funny, scary, spooky goodies. So join us live next Friday, October 30th, and, of course, thereafter on podcast for the Halloween Spooktacular. But we'll give you a little taste here and there. Here's one. I guess, well, the late 50s. I did a little research the last couple of days over this, last week or so. Late 50s, early 60s was a plethora of these great rock and roll Halloween tunes. Here's one from Jumpin' Gene Simmons. No, not the Gene Simmons from Kiss, but a rockabilly star back then. It's called Haunted House on the Amoeba Darkly Show.
I just moved in my new house today. Moving was hard, but I got squared away. Bell started ringing and chains rattled out. I knew I'd moved in a haunted house. Still I made up in my mind to stay. Nothing was gonna drive me away. When I seen something to give me the creep, had one big eye and a two big feet. I stood right still and I did the freeze. He did the stroll right up to me, made a noise with his feet that sounded like a drum. Say you'll be here when the morning comes. I'll be here when the morning comes. I'll be right here and I ain't gonna run. I bought this house, now you know I'm bald. Ain't no hang gonna run me on. In my kitchen, my stove was a blazing hot. The coffee was a boiling in the pot. Melted in my hand. I had a hunk of meat in my hand. From outer space I sat a man. On a hot stove was a pot and pan. Say that pot, I began to shout. He drank a hot coffee right from the spout. He ate the raw meat right from my hand. Drank a hot grease from the frying pan. And said to me, now you better run. Don't be here when the morning comes. See if I'll be here when the morning comes. I'll be right here and I ain't gonna.
He's mad, he's mad.
The man is mad.
Monty, yes, fearless leader. Bring the ashes from the crematorium. Pour the hot water over it.
Aha! Instant Fipo!
Boy, is he nuts.
Thank you.
it couldn't be done. They tried to tell me it couldn't be done. They were right. It can't be done. Avoid this man. They got to drop the net over him. Oh, loony!
See, I told you it wouldn't hurt there.
Got a chiller theater vibe to it, doesn't it? The Zany is from 1958. And Mad Scientist on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. If they did a video, Vincent Price would be starring in it for sure. So you getting ready? You going to have a party next week? Because Halloween comes out on a Saturday, so get ready. I'm sure we'll have, you know, up from no trick-or-treaters to maybe five, so I better buy 12 bags of candy for next week. Anyway, if you're planning a party, here's a cautionary tale we found from the folks at College Humor. It's a Monster Mash bash busted.
Dracula's party was underway. He'd invited all the monsters the other day. The ghoulish girls and the ghastly guys. Then to his horror, he realized
it wasn't fun.
It was a monster bus.
It wasn't fun.
Because nobody'd come.
His night was rough.
The snacks went untouched.
He dimmed and fussed.
It was a monster bus. Zombie canceled to take care of his dog. The mummy said he didn't want to drive in the fog. Frankenstein's bride got a headache and ditched. Gotta get up early, said the troll and the witch. The goblin claimed illness from an uncooked clam, but posted selfies at a club on Instagram.
Don't worry,
said Drac.
We'll get it rockin', you see. I've got 140 maybe RSVPs.
It was a bust.
It was a monster bust.
It was a mess.
A total sausage fest.
He planned a bash.
But now his hopes were smashed.
Not like an ass.
Suggesting they play balderdash. There was no hard liquor, just a table of chasers. The skeleton sat alone and watched the pacers. The speakers broke and made a hissing sound. Said the banshee, there's a better party 2 doors down. Then came the wolfman, drunk on boxed wine. Sat everyone down and made them watch his vines. Saw his ex-girlfriend, ran to the bathroom and sobbed. Then came back out and yelled, the toilet is clogged. Drac's roommate Kevin heard all the noises.
I've got a midterm in the morning, use your inside voices.
A demon smoked a joint and pot filled the air.
Kev said, no, my landlord can smell it upstairs.
It was a monster bus.
The night was through.
And the cabs were few.
Drac's friends had fled.
So he crawled into bed.
Began to weep.
And cried himself to sleep.
We are a classy bunch.
enemy number one. Running and hiding from every American lawman's gun. They used to laugh about dying, but deep inside them they knew that pretty soon they'd be lying beneath the ground together, pushing up there just to welcome the sun and the morning. Deputation laid a deadly ambush. When Bonnie and Clyde came walking in the sunshine, half a dozen carbines opened up on them. Finally together they died.
He was sitting in the lounge of the Empire Hotel. He was drinking for diversion. He was thinking for himself. Blue money riding on a maple leaf. Along comes a lady in lacy sleeves.
As we segue back to our interview with crime author Donna Thomas. Fascinating stuff there indeed. And Trudy, thanks for finding that great tune from the folks at College Humor. What a lot of fun that is, the Monster Mash Bash Busted. More of those spectacular songs, a preview again on Tuesday, and then we'll do the real deal next Friday. Also on Tuesday's show, you'll meet fellow mystery author Tim Hall. So join us for that. And, of course, the usual romps of the crazy, chaotic sideshow. Speaking of which, our final romps of the Twitter feed today. A couple of 40 of your regulars chiming in. Cynthia says, another great show. Really enjoyed the interview, especially your comments and the music. Love those Halloween tunes. Vintage, yeah. Okay, thanks, Cynthia. Johnny Fever's Hangover, heard some of the show, really great as usual. We'll catch it all on podcast. Indeed, thanks for the reminder. All the shows are archived for podcasts. You can follow us in, everywhere these days. Find us on the Blog Talk Radio site, also Mixcloud, Stitcher, get the portable app for that. And select editions, I'm so pleased to say, are available via the Arts Radio Network and PopNet. Want to find us? You'll find us. All roads, of course, lead back to the website, amybetharkowi.com. That's the place for guest suggestions, creativity coaching commentary, and questions, as, of course, the Eliza Gordon Mystery Series. Enough self-promotion already. Hey, before we go, I do want to mention, sadly, the passing of Corey Wells. He was one of the three lead singers of Three Dog Night, a band which endured for years, had a string of hits in the 70s. I don't think they ever really got the critical success they deserve, and a lot of folks think they should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, as that debate rages on. But he died suddenly the other day, and Danny Hutton, who one of the other original members, said he's so saddened. They were together since 1965. Wow. Corey Wells suddenly died at the age of 74. Lots of great music with his compadres. This is one of theirs called Jambala. Three Dog Night on the Amy Bitarkoe Show.
Well done. Very solid work.
Another day, another opportunity to impress everyone.
Well, guys, I think we've all learned a valuable lesson here today.
And another adventure draws to a close.
When I say good, you say bye, good.
Another good show. Thank you so much for joining us. Donna Thomas, the intriguing crime writer who's covered in Bethel, plethora of notorious crime cases. Thanks for joining us. Intriguing stories indeed. Thank you so much for tweeting with us in real time. Keep doing it 24/7. Follow me at Twitter at AB Writes. You can follow our producer Trudy Hart at Radio Trudy. Friend me on Facebook and, of course, hop over to the website, amybetharkowy.com. Thanks so much for joining us today. Stress-free weekend because the Mets aren't playing until Tuesday. So go out there and enjoy the autumn air. Drive safe, play nice, dream big. Please come back and see us on the Amy Beth Arkowy Show. We'll leave you with one more for Corey Wells from Three Dog Night. Sure as I'm sitting here. Take care.
Come on, sit down.